Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today was a priest in the Church of England before leaving the ministry in 1991. He's been a Labour Member of Parliament since 2001 and has written biographies of Sir Stafford Cripps and Glenda Jackson, as well as his two-volume Parliament, A Biography. His most recent book, entitled A Critical History of the British Aristocracy, explores the nefarious side of the upper classes. An ardent advocate against leaving the European Union, his civil partnership was the first same-sex union to take place in the Houses of Parliament. And on the show ahead, he tells us about his life and work in opposition politics. Chris Bryant, thanks so much for coming on Meet the Writers.
Thank you for having me.
Such an interesting life, and I'm not quite sure where to start. You grew up, though, here in England before heading off to Latin America.
Well, in Wales, to be precise.
Not in England.
Just to be a bit of a stickler. No, well, oddly, my parents met in Spain when my dad was working in a hotel there and my mother was on holiday. So part of my early life was actually in Spain from the age of 7 till 12, which is why I don't sound very Welsh at all. Though my father's called Rhys and my brother's called Rodri and my great-great-granduncle was captain of the Welsh team. And then I was ordained in the church, and part of my training I spent in Latin America in a shantytown in Lima first, and then working for a human rights organisation in Buenos Aires.
So tell me about your journey into the church, because that's obviously not a decision taken lightly and you have to go through several stages before you are ordained.
I remember my mother sitting at the foot of my bed on my 13th birthday and telling me that she drank too much. And she probably had more insight in that night than in many others over the coming years. And she was alcoholic, and it sort of pulled the family apart. It gave her terrible heartache and all of us as well. I think my brother and I were both quite bruised by it all. And by the time I went to university, Mum was really quite a mess. And the people who looked after me and gave me support were mostly people in the church. And as it happens, the first weekend I arrived at Oxford, I went to church. I kept on going to church and I found that my faith gave me a sort of strength. And I wanted to give something back because of that. And I think that's why I became a priest rather than any kind of grand kind of metaphysical moment.
And then going off to Latin America, of course, that really is giving back in a very physical way. It's a very hands-on way to practice your faith.
It was an extraordinary time. I mean, Peru at the time had just come out of dictatorship and had Alan Garcia was the president, but he was only 34 at the time. It was a time of hope, but there was a terrible campaign of violence, terrorist violence. I was involved in one incident myself up in the north of the country where there was an explosion in the room I was in and several people were killed. And I was mugged one night in Lima. But it was just fascinating to me to see people who, in most people's understanding in the UK, had absolutely nothing, who were immensely rich. You know, they have more avocados in Peru than any other country in the world. They say they have 365 different kinds of potato and so on. So it felt like there was this wealth and phenomenal poverty, and that seemed wrong and iniquitous. And so I wanted to help change that in the world. And then I went to Chile, and it was the last kind of vicious period of the Pinochet dictatorship, and I was at the funeral of a young boy who'd had petrol poured over him by the police and had been set fire to, and the police all came into the cathedral with water cannons and tear gas and sprayed us all out of the way, including the family who were trying to hold on to the coffin, and all of us who were not Chilean were told we had to leave the country within 24 hours, which meant that I was able to leave with a video of what had happened.
And do you think that people in extreme situations like that, where they do live in poverty and surrounded by violence, turn to religion because there is nothing else? Or is religion so central to their being that that would happen anyway?
I think it depends a bit on how you read your Bible. I'm not a fundamentalist in anything. I'm not a fundamentalist in religion or in politics, for that matter. I find all messianic cults a bit disturbing. That's why I'm an Anglican rather than anything else, because I believe that we have an innate ability to think and use our rational minds to be able to discover things about the world in which we live rather than just make up six impossible things before breakfast.
Well, the joke about Anglicans, of course, is that we don't really believe in God.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, there are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. My favourite Gospel is Mark because it has no virgin birth and no resurrection. It's just the story of Jesus' life and teaching. And it ends with the women coming to the garden and finding the stone has been rolled away. And they run away, and the Greek word is ephobuntagar, for they were afraid. That's the last line. And that sense of fear and awe and wondering, I think, isn't still, for me, and the teaching of Jesus, I think, is impeccable. Sorry, I wasn't expecting to do that kind of religious bit with you. But and I find the Anglican, all churches terribly irritating because they have strictures and hierarchies and all that kind of stuff, which is everything I dislike in life.
Well, and in fact, you ended up leaving the priesthood.
Yes, though I think that was largely because round about the age of 24, I worked out that I was gay. Well, in fact, my girlfriend told me so. Whilst in the past, the church's view had been, don't ask, don't tell, it had changed to, we want to know everything about everybody. And by the way, homosexuality is immoral. And so I thought, well, I know gay clergy. Lots of Anglican clergy in the inner cities, parishes were gay. Families didn't want to go and work there. Some of them were quite bitter about life. They no longer had a faith. They felt rejected by the church. They were lonely. And I just didn't want to be that person when I was 65.
But a big leap, though. I mean, going from almost like a family structure out into the world.
Very oddly, the very first night, I remember arriving in London and I'd been preaching in Peterborough Cathedral. It was Maundy Thursday. And I arrived in London and all my furniture had just been put in the flat, in my new flat, by the removal people. And I just couldn't be bothered to do anything about it. So I just went to the local gay pub. This was my moment of freedom. And I ordered a pint at the bar and suddenly realised I'd not brought my wallet with me. And it was sitting there. And I went, I'm really sorry, I've not got my wallet. And this little chap standing next to me said, it's all right, I'll pay. And it was Jimmy Somerville.
Oh, wow. How extraordinary. And did you keep up a friendship with him?
Yes, we sort of remained friends. We bump into each other now and again. And I've got him to perform a few gigs. And we come from a very similar sort of political view of life.
So in all of this time, too, you work for a charity. You also work for the BBC.
Yes, I've done nearly every major institution. I've brought them to their knees. I think for Paul Dacre, who used to be the editor of the Daily Mail, that must have been an absolute nightmare. Pro-European, BBC, gay. A male once described me as an ex-gay vicar. Now, I think they meant a gay ex-vicar, because the gay thing's coming along quite well.
You were also writing during this time, and your first book was Possible Dreams, Personal History of the British Christian Socialists. That was way back in 1996.
That's right, and that's because I'd left the church and started working for the Labour Party. I got very much involved in an organisation called the Christian Socialist Movement, which, oddly enough, had been created by two men, Donald Soper, who was a Methodist and quite prim in a way, and Tom Dryberg, who was a Labour MP who was gay and was far from prim. So I was involved in that and I persuaded Tony Blair and John Smith to do lectures for us and edited a book of essays with them. And the publisher said to me, well, why don't you write a history of all of this? And there's some absolutely fascinating people. And out of that then sprang my next book, which was a biography of Stafford Cripps, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer, Labour Chancellor after the war, nearly became Prime Minister, nearly ousted Churchill in 1942. And there hadn't been a biography of him since the 1950s.
Mm. And when you look at him and his life and his decisions, his fiscal decisions, and compare them to now, is there an enormous difference?
The Stafford Cripps from before the Second World War was a hardline Marxist. The Stafford Cripps in office after the war was a very different man who believed in just trying to make things work. He was up for plans that worked, basically. He felt crucified by a moment when he had to devalue the pound. When he came off the ship back from the United States of America, having agreed the new rate, he was asked whether he was going to devalue the pound and he had to lie. He had to say, no, I'm not going to, because otherwise he would have, by doing that, have devalued it in that instance. I think he felt quite crushed by having to do that.
Your next book, then, was completely and utterly different and is about a woman who's changed the course of my life, I have to tell you.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because I used to be an actress. And then I suddenly realised one day that I was never going to be Glenda Jackson. And then Glenda Jackson herself stopped being Glenda Jackson, at which point I gave up.
She's back being Glenda Jackson now. Yeah. I don't know whether you saw her in King Lear. An absolutely amazing performance. I mean, I've never seen a person look more like a man with dementia on stage.
She was absolutely incredible. I mean, she always has been. I think she is the most talented actress of our generation.
Extraordinary person. And extraordinary because she's a very, very private person. She was sort of in favour of me doing the book, but all the interviews that we did, she sat with her back to me throughout the interview in a small room the size of a cupboard.
That's so interesting. So she wasn't able to have eye contact with you while she was talking
about
herself?
Not at all. And oddly, I mean, there were strange things, like she'd always believed she was brought up in a particular street in Birkenhead, and she wasn't. I mean, that house that she thought she was brought in up in never existed. And I was able to prove it to her, and she was quite angry with me, I think, when I could prove to her. And it was fascinating meeting some of the people she'd worked with. I went over to Hollywood and met with, you know, all the leading people that she'd done all those big films up against, including Walter Matthau, whose agent told me I was going to have 10 minutes. I was there for 3.5 hours whilst he was explaining to me how he'd managed to sign the Stockholm Peace Pledge, which was the key thing that the McCarthyites used to prove that you were actually a communist. He'd signed it deliberately, illegibly, so that he had the moral justification of feeling he was signing up, but not at the same time getting into trouble. And he always said that Glenda was a more courageous person than he was.
And did she like the book?
Probably not, because she is such a private person. And it's strange that she's done two very public careers, acting and politics, but is so almost painfully private. And in Parliament, I was in Parliament with her after writing the book, and she'd never said hello to anybody. She was very guarded. It was slightly strange. There was a terrible moment. I was working for Frank Dobson in the 1997 general election campaign, and Glenda was in the next door seat. She was the candidate. She'd not yet been elected. And this was in 92 when she first stood. Frank Dobson's daughter, Sally Dobson, was working for Glenda, and she and I were helping run Glenda. And we were a bit worried that party members were a bit fed up with Glenda because she turned up in a jogging suit and everybody was thinking, excuse me, you're a Hollywood actress. You should be turning up in something a bit more glamorous. And we are Hampstead after all, darling. So we said to her she had to dress a bit better. She wasn't very happy with that. And then we said, and you've got to send them all Christmas cards. And she said, but I don't believe in Christmas. And we said, well, you've got to do something because everybody's a bit fed up and you need them to go out door knocking. So she said, I know what I'll do. I will write Glenda cards to them and I will write them all by hand. So she wrote out 2,673 cards by hand, longhand. We put them in envelopes and she did the names and addresses. We put stamps on them and we were going to take them to the post office the next day. And that night there was a flood in the office and it was all ruined. And Sally and I to this day have never told Glenda. But 3 months later, she said to us, I told you that was a waste of time. Nobody's ever commented on them.
Oh, no. Oh, that's hilarious. Of course, you then followed in her footsteps and stood for Parliament yourself.
Yes, I worked for the BBC for a couple of years, running the office in Brussels, basically trying to make sure that Rupert Murdoch didn't win any battles over broadcasting laws in Europe fairly successfully. And was selected by the Labour Party in 2000 in the Rhondda and then elected in 2001. I mean, all the national newspapers wrote stories like how pink was my valley, how the Rhondda would never vote for a gay man and all this kind of stuff, all of which proved to be nonsense. Mm.
You held various ministerial positions. So you were Minister for Europe.
I was the last Labour Minister for Europe. I hope not the last one ever, but I was the last one under Gordon, yes. Which was, to me, an ideal job because I'd worked in Brussels. I speak Spanish and French. I can even pretend Italian if I've had a few and everybody else has had even more. And I believe that we're stronger if we work together. I was a Remainer, I remain a Remainer, and I'll remain a Remainer until my dying day.
What about your constituency?
So my constituency was not a Remain constituency. It voted Leave. It's difficult to know exactly what percentage because you didn't have figures by constituency. We had them by the local authority area, which is much bigger. But I'm guessing it was something like 58, 59% Leave. So when we came to the vote on Article 50, that was a really difficult moment for me. This was triggering leaving. Some people said that I should do what my constituency had voted. But in my conscience, I couldn't do anything other than what I truly believed. And My husband had paid for us to go to the States in first for the first time ever for my birthday. I'd never flown in first. We were going for a weekend in New York. And the flight was on that day. And I suppose a coward in me would have said, oh, well, we're going off and I'll pair with some Tory or other. But I thought, no, I've got to do what I really believe. And when I hang up my boots, I will want to have been there at this moment. And I decided to speak. And I said, I know that this is not what many of my constituents would hope I would vote, but I can only vote for what I really believe in. I believe this will truly damage my constituency and the country and international peace and so on. And if I lose my seat because of it, then I'll lose my seat because of it. And then I guess I was expecting the general election to be in 2020 when I said that in March 2017. But then we had an election 8 weeks later and I doubled my majority. So I don't know what that says. Probably nothing. But in the end, I think there's no point in politicians trying to chase their own tail. You have to do what you believe, and we probably don't have enough politicians who feel that way.
I think you've absolutely got a point there. I'm trying to understand how a constituency who is absolutely fine with having a gay MP would then vote Leave.
I don't know that there's a correlation between those two things, but the bit that I think for a lot of my constituents, they saw David Cameron and George Osborne trying to bully them into voting Remain. And that didn't work for them because they just saw them as Tories telling fibs. This is why I was quite angry with my own party, because I felt that we weren't putting a strong enough argument why Labour people should vote Remain. I was the only person in the Shadow Cabinet who said week after week after week to Jeremy, if you keep on saying that fish is off, eventually people won't buy fish, even if you say that they should. And that's what I felt that we were doing about Brussels. You know, Jeremy kept on saying, you know, the EU is broken, it's too much of a capitalist club, blah, 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 blah. But nonetheless, we should remain. Labour voters, a lot of them only heard the first half.
Well, of course, you were shadow leader of the House of Commons in the shadow cabinet. And I mean, you disagreed with Corbyn fundamentally on that issue, as you said.
Yes, and I think in the end, the reason we all resigned from the shadow cabinet was more an emotional spasm in reaction to losing that referendum than anything else. Because for me, this is just, it's an article of faith. It's not a policy like another policy. It's just that fundamental belief that if we share our, well, it's John Donne. No man is an island entire unto himself. Seek not to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Any man's death diminishes me because I am a part of humanity.
You didn't stop writing. You're still a Member of Parliament and you've still been writing. Now, you wrote a two-part biography of Parliament.
It was meant to be one. The thing is, it covers an enormous span of history. I started with the 13th century and took it all the way up to the fall of Thatcher. And I wanted to make sure that there was proper representation of women in it. And that's quite difficult, obviously, until later on. You know, there are so many twists and turns in all of that history that I wanted to do it properly. So I ended up handing in far too much. And I thought my editor would scrub lots of it, but he didn't. He said, let's turn it into two volumes.
And it remains a valuable, I want to call it reference book, but it's...
Oddly, sometimes I reread bits of it because I think, oh gosh, I need that fact. I know it's the safest place to find it. And yeah. Also, I'd uncovered quite a lot of mistakes in other people's histories of Parliament and stuff, and I wanted to abolish some of the myths. The most basic one of which is that, I don't know whether you've ever been in a chamber of the House of Commons, but if you are, you will probably be told that the two red lines on the carpet are two swords' lengths apart so that we couldn't draw our swords and kill one another. Mm-hmm. This is complete and utter tosh, invented by the Victorians. By the time the Victorians built that chamber after the fire of 1834, which is the first time there was a carpet or any red lines anywhere, you hadn't been allowed to carry a sword into the chamber for 250 years. So it's complete and utter British myth-making.
How wonderful. And the book busts a lot of that type of myth.
That was sort of the aim, really, yes. Yeah. And, you know, like this, the mother of all parliaments, which is a terrible phrase that people have bastardised. John Bright, who originally used this term, his term was England, which has mothered parliaments. And he was complaining that the majority of people still didn't have the vote. He wasn't praising England. He was criticising it.
You yourself made parliamentary history when you became, well, the first person to have a civil partnership.
In Parliament, yes, physically in Parliament. You'd always, as an MP, you'd always been able to get married in the Crypt Chapel or St Mary's Undercroft. But obviously that's just for heterosexual couples because it's run by the Church of England. It's a peculiar of the Anglican Church. And so not available to same-sex couples. And anyway, I don't think my partner and I would have wanted to get married in a church.
Despite your religious background?
Yes, well, he's a sort of Catholic and I'm a sort of Anglican now. So, no, we wouldn't have wanted that. And we wouldn't have wanted to rub anybody's noses and all of that. And we wanted to do our own thing. We wanted to be able to write our own vows, not least because Jared insisted that the first thing I had to pledge was that I would never make him eat fish. And I'm not sure that that would fit in Cranmer's language. He incidentally repeated, he gave back that he would never make me watch Sex in the City 2, the film.
Have you both stuck to it?
I've certainly kept to the first one. He did point in a bar once to a bit of Sex in the City 2, which was on a screen. Now, whether that is forcing
grounds
me to
for
watch,
divorce.
I know it's not. he'd be furious that I've told you this story, but the law didn't allow us to do that. Parliament wasn't registered for weddings other than in the chapel. So we had to get the law changed and we had to get Parliament opened up. And in fact, now anybody can get married. Any member of the public can get married in Parliament. It's a place that, you know, just like any other venue. It's just that we were the first.
Congratulations.
Stella Black came.
She came?
She invited herself, sort of, in that a friend. We'd invited a friend who knew her and he had his invite on the mantelpiece. And so she saw it and decided that she'd never been to a civil partnership and she'd like to come. And we said, of course, you must. And she was delightful. She was very generous. My mother-in-law kept on saying that she was a Tory, but they ended up sitting on the steps of the Speaker's House with a bottle of champagne each, drinking themselves silly. So it was all rather fun.
Regretting that I didn't get crushed. You have a new book out. It's called Entitled, A Critical History of the British Aristocracy. It looks completely fabulous. Mary Beard has blurbed it, as has Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Yes. I think Jacob thinks it's scurrilous nonsense.
But, he says annoying and readable in equal measure.
Yes. Nicholas Soames has read it as well, and he thinks it's outrageous piece of literature. This came from the fact that when I wrote the Parliament biography, I ended up focusing a lot on the House of Commons rather than the House of Lords, but I was conscious that that was missing out a chunk of British history. So this, my history of the aristocracy, covers the same span of time, except it goes right up today and starts a little bit earlier. It starts before the Norman Conquest with King Canute and kind of Anglo-Saxon stuff as well. And I got more and more angry as I wrote the book about them, which is why it ended up being called Entitled, because it was that sense of entitlement, both to land and wealth and the arrogance of the aristocracy, that increasingly infuriated me.
Mm, and it's something that you must be very aware of. In Parliament, there are a lot of aristos wandering about there.
Yes, there's the 92 of them. But actually, part of my criticism is that what I think they've managed to do over the last 100 years is they've pleaded poverty when everybody's seen their poor, massive mansions, which were never sustainable, really, were in decay. And they've managed to persuade the taxpayer to give them massive tax breaks so as to look after them and still live in them. They've pulled out of all their public duties. You know, they don't do much politicking anymore. They don't stand for public office. They don't engage much in local communities. They've never historically been great patrons of the art in this country. They've tended to buy art from other countries that were of established value already, or get foreigners to paint them. Quite different from arts patronage in other aristocracies around the world. And now they are just as wealthy as they were. They still hold the same landholdings, except they get vast amounts of money from the Common Agricultural Policy and will still get it under the new agricultural policy if we leave the European Union.
What about noblesse oblige, the small number, admittedly, of people who do really take their responsibility as people born into great privilege to give back and to look after those under their care? That sounds patronising, but I guess perhaps that is the way it works.
Yes, undoubtedly. And, you know, Lord Shaftesbury, you know, there was a strand of that, which I think was quite prominent. But actually, if you look at the map of central London today, which has some of the most expensive real estate in the world, we still have a system where you don't actually buy your flat or even your house. You buy a lease on it for an X number of years and keep on paying normally the aristocratic landlord a chunk of money. So The Cadogan estate, the Westminster estate, the Bedford estate.
We're sitting here in a Howard de Walden estate.
I was about to say. Exactly. And that still rakes in vast amounts of money. And it has managed to do so because of all the tax benefits that they've managed to sort out for themselves. And they managed to do that because they had dominance of Parliament for so many centuries, not just sitting in the House of Lords, so every law had to go through the Commons and the Lords, but also in the House of Commons, because they had their sons and their cousins and all the rest sitting in the House of Commons. Mm.
You give us some wonderful character sketches, though. I mean, we look at greed and ambition and jealousy and rivalry, but also there are fierce warriors, there are rakish dandies, political dilettantes, eccentrics and all the rest of it.
And there's some great women. I mean, they had a rough time in the British aristocracy because they were not allowed to inherit in the main. There's a few that I like the sound of. There was one Duchess of Sutherland who basically her sole aim in life was to, though she had grown up in relative poverty, was basically to make sure that all her children were extremely well provided for and married off extremely well. And when she failed to get the fifth Duke of Bedford to marry her last remaining daughter, she nonetheless went for the sixth Duke of Bedford when the fifth died. And there are some great figures like that. Another thing that wound me up was I'd never really investigated the slave trade quite as closely, and I don't think anybody else has, in relation to the aristocracy. Mm. It was a key part of establishing like Harwood House and the Earls of Harwood's family monies. And incidentally, why do they all mispronounce their names?
Harewood Howard.
Harewood House, yeah. Harwood, the Cholmondeleys, the Fanshawes, the Featherstone Hawes, and so on. Even the Cecils pretend that they're really the Sicils because they want to suggest that they come from an aristocratic Welsh family from the 10th century, which they don't.
Yeah. I suppose it's all this part of being a very exclusive club, and if you're not one of us, then you can't really say it properly.
Exactly. That's what it feels like. Now, you know, people might suggest that this, I've got a terrible chip on my shoulder, and the moment I'm given a viscountcy, I'll get over it. And I did end up learning extraordinary things about the legal system of inheriting land in this country, which has been, you know, very difficult. But one of the strange things after the Norman conquest was the Norman system of inheritance was that the eldest son had to inherit everything that the father had inherited, the patrimony. But the younger sons could have anything that the father had acquired. And because William the Conqueror inherited the dukedom of Normandy, his eldest son became Duke of Normandy, but his younger son could take England and could be a king of England. So all these Norman lords who'd come over with him had lands in Normandy and in England, and they owed dual allegiance, both to a king in England and a duke in Normandy. And sometimes that was quite difficult for them to swallow. But it also meant that all younger sons were desperate for their father to grab new land off somebody, because otherwise they weren't going to inherit anything. Mm.
It's absolutely fascinating stuff. It's a great book. It's called, entitled, A Critical History of the British Aristocracy, and it's published by Penguin. Now, that's not all, though, because you're working on a new book, which also sounds absolutely extraordinary. So give us a little bit of detail about The Glamour Boys.
It's called The Glamour Boys because this is about a group of mostly Tory, gay and bisexual, I call them queer or nearly queer, MPs from the 1930s, who at the beginning of the 1930s loved to go to Germany and Berlin in particular because there was a sexual freedom that they could enjoy there which was completely illegal in this country. And you could be sent to prison for 7 years with hard labour for homosexuality in this country at the time. They met lots of the early gay Nazis like Ernst Röhm and Edmund Heinz and people. But they were all killed off in 1934 in the Night of the Long Knives by Hitler. And so these men in Britain became the most ferocious opponents of Hitler. They gave the earliest warnings about him, and they demanded that Britain should rearm and face Hitler down rather than appease him. Neville Chamberlain, who became the Prime Minister in 1937, hated them, and he called them the Glamour Boys. He invented the term as a way of suggesting that there was something effeminate and not quite right about them. But they kept on making their speeches. He had their phones tapped, had them followed, had them threatened with deselection. And they kept on making these speeches right up until the eve of war. Those who were young enough, all of them signed up, enlisted, and went off and fought. And six of them were killed in action in the war. Very brave, brave circumstances. And they have shields up in the chamber of the House of Commons to commemorate them.
When will it be published?
Next year. I've got to hand it in by the 29th of March. Your birthday.
And an auspicious day for other reasons too. That is, of course, Brexit, which...
Or not.
And this is what I need to ask you. Or not?
Well, the one word you will never find anywhere in any of the books I've ever written is the word inevitable, because nothing is ever inevitable in politics. I'm in the world of, if possible, persuading the British people in a second referendum that we shouldn't go ahead, because we were lied to. The Russians tried to influence the vote and I think succeeded. Boris Johnson et al, you know, lied and lied again. And if I can't do that, then at least to have as soft a Brexit as possible.
Finally, Chris, how on earth do you have the time to do all of that, to do your parliamentary work and to write these wonderful books?
My husband gets up early, which is very irritating. But once he's up and is pounding round the flat, I might as well be up and writing. There's that. And because I don't go to church on Sundays anymore, I've got Sunday mornings. I have the kind of mind which can have something working away in the back. If I've got 20 minutes in the library, I'll get 20 minutes work done. And then I can go back into the Chamber of the House of Commons and do a speech about whatever.
Well, I'm so pleased that you're so prolific in the literary world and also so committed in the political. Chris Bryant, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, David Stevens and Helena Jarrett. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.